From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, practicing combat medicine during urban warfare in Iraq. We talk with Navy doctor Commander Richard Jaddick. He was awarded the Bronze Medal with a Combat V for Valor for his work during the Battle of Fallujah. Jaddick and his fellow Medical Corps men set up their emergency rooms in the middle of the battle where the wounded were, instead of setting them up in safer places miles away. This enabled the soldiers to get to medical care more quickly, and that was especially important when 3 minutes could mean the difference between life and death. Jaddick has written a memoir called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Weirdness, the first album in almost 35 years by Iggy Pop and the Stooges. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Dr. Richard Jaddick, practiced combat medicine under fire in urban warfare during the Battle of Fallujah in November 2004. Instead of setting up the medical aid stations safely behind the front lines, he set them up in the battle in order to get to the wounded quickly. American troops faced an estimated 5,000 to 9,000 insurgents in Fallujah. Jaddick's battalion, the 1st Battalion 8th Marine Regiment, lost 21 men killed in action. 200 were too seriously wounded to carry on the fight. Commander Jaddick received a Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor. Just before deploying, Jaddick had been working as a surgeon with the Marines at Camp Lejeune. When he heard there was a shortage of military doctors going to Iraq, he volunteered, even though he was 38, older than most battalion surgeons, and his wife was about to have a baby. After returning home from Iraq, he was the subject of a Newsweek cover story. Now he's written a memoir called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. Dr. Jaddick, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe what the American soldiers faced in the Battle of Fallujah in 2004?
Sure. Every American soldier, Marine, and sailor who went in was really looking at a well-dug-in defensive system of insurgents who had been there for quite some time. Fallujah was never really occupied or patrolled very seriously by the American forces before any of this, and then it became a hotbed of insurgency. So the insurgents had their way throughout the city to dig whatever defensive systems, perimeters, set up makeshift hospitals, that kind of thing, for a long time. So we were looking at a well-entrenched urban fight that I think really kind of, as you look at weapon systems, takes away the technical advantage that our military has.
Now, you basically set up aid stations in the heart of the Battle of Fallujah. You were working under enemy fire. Why was it important to you to set up aid stations in the battle as opposed to doing it more safely in the rear, which was typically what's done?
Well, when I began looking at the plan, and I really looked at every time we went out on an operation or some sort of patrolling system where we had our troops somewhere, I always looked at it as to how was the best way for me to care for the Marines that were out there, and that's my job. So it made sense for me to really analyze this urban battlefield and figure out how can we get the Marines most efficiently to medical care. And what made sense to me and what has always made sense to me was not trying to bring the Marine to the medicine, but bring the medicine to the Marine. And when I went initially, prior to the battle, we went on a recon. I went with the command element, and we went out around the perimeter to draw fire. It was obvious to me that this was a long drive from there back to the surgical hospital to get any kind of real treatment. And once you got into the middle of the city, you never knew how long it was going to be from getting a Marine from the point of injury back to any kind of care. So my thought, and when I presented to the colonel, the thought was, let's get our people as far forward so that there's only a 5-minute difference between the time they're injured and the time they get some significant medical care.
So what kind of places did you set up your aid stations in?
Well, we set, really it was two aid stations. I set up a very full, robust aid station at the at the forward edge of the battle area, or what we call the FEBA. We had an assembly point just behind the FEBA. I set up with the second physician of there's two physicians in a battalion, and he ran most of the corpsmen. I took six other corpsmen into downtown Fallujah at the government center, and in a little prayer room inside that government center, we set up our second aid station. And what that did to us was give us one aid station that would cover the whole southern end of the battlefield and one aid station that would cover the northern end. So it really was, you know, 5 minutes from point of injury to a physician or a significant provider with trauma experience.
What were the typical wounds that you saw in the Battle of Fallujah?
The typical wounds, because of the body armor that we all wore, were extremity wounds. We saw a lot of, arm, leg wounds, and some significant head wounds. The wounds, though, that we saw that were really concerning were anything that got in between the plates in the upper body armor, which didn't happen really too often. I had a couple of shots to the chest, and but the other one that was very life-threatening was there was a lot of wounds to the inner groin area that became the wound that was really the most concerning, because all the vessels that are packed in there and the difficulty it is, you can't put a tourniquet around it. You have to really just put your hand in there and pack it. So those were the wounds we saw, and we learned very quickly how to deal successfully with the groin and kind of chest wounds.
Why were there so many groin injuries? Was there no body armor in that area of the body?
There is not. It's a joint. It's very difficult to put any kind of armor in there. You can armor in, and you could put a Marine in complete armor, but then he doesn't move around very well. So there's trade-offs. You need to armor as much as you can. However, you don't want to. You're giving a guy an extra 12 pounds of body armor, as well as a very large contingent of ammo and the gear he's going to need to be through this city and live for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks. So adding more armor makes it difficult. I took it as our challenge was to figure out how to save those people who were shot in those areas. And I think, we were very successful with that.
Were insurgents intentionally targeting the groin area because they knew that was a vulnerable part of the body?
You know, there's some thoughts to that. I think the insurgents were very adaptive, and they had come up with any number of ways to get around some of the innovations, and they still do. But I think, I personally think that, yes, there was too many wounds in those areas that led me to believe that maybe there was some targeting going on in the lower extremity, specifically in the groin region, and especially from snipers. There were quite a few snipers out there that were well-trained and taking very good shots.
What was it like the first time you treated a severe groin injury before you figured out how to treat it?
I'll never forget. The first time was the day after the battle kicked off, and we had gone into the city. And once in the city, we got a call. I was in the ambulance, and we were taking one Marine out who had been shot in the chest, and actually it was a Navy Corpsman Force Recon kid. And we got a call to go into the middle of an ambush area, so we moved the ambulance down there, and that's when I saw my first groin injury, and it was Sergeant Lonnie Wells, and he came over, and it was relatively chaotic, but I did everything I could. I packed that wound. I tried to stop the bleeding, and I couldn't. I had six other wounded Marines, so triage became what I had to do, a very dirty word, sorting out and moving on. And as I rode back in the ambulance, I played this over my mind a million times. What did I do or didn't do that could have changed this course of events for Sergeant Wells? And Sergeant Wells became a pivotal point where I realized that we were there pretty quickly, and I got to him before he lost all, before he passed on us. But I didn't do the right things to save his life, and I wasn't sure why I wasn't able to pack that wound tighter or make the move to change the course of events. So when we got him out of there, I really thought about it for about an hour, because that's all the time I had before PFC Volpe came in with the same wound. He had the same wound. He was unconscious and pale as a ghost and in shock. And he came in, and I realized that I didn't pack tight enough on Sergeant Wells, and that I needed to put my hand in there and grab everything I can and just keep as much compression on his vessels. And that's what I did. We pushed some fluid in. The outcome was a lot different for PFC Volpe. After that, as I sat down and kind of reworked this thing, I knew that we had to be as close as we could because these kids will bleed out in 5-10 minutes. And I also knew that we were going to need to really be aggressive in treating any kind of bleeding with tourniquets and compression and IV fluids.
How do you do triage in the middle of a battle?
You look at your wounds, you look at what's around you, and you assess. Really, my triage was, who can I get to and save their life within the next 3 minutes by some sort of intervention? Who is anybody who's going to require more of my time than that? I don't know if I can spend that much time with them. And that's it. I mean, there's NATO and U.S. triage categories, but I really didn't use many of those. I used those who weren't going to die no matter what I did, and they were just wounded. Those who were going to die if I didn't do anything, and those who were going to take too much of my time that the others may pass away because I spent too much time with them.
There's something called the golden hour in battlefield medicine, which is the hour that you often have to intervene medically if you are to save somebody's life. But you're saying that it's really not an hour anymore. It's often like 3 minutes.
I'm certainly saying that an hour is too long. I think the hour, and really the hour comes from United States basic trauma studies, it doesn't come from battlefield trauma. It's more about blunt trauma, and it takes a whole bunch of patients and looks at them saying, okay, how many died after an hour, how many died before an hour? And your survival rate before an hour is much greater than after an hour. However, the reality of it is if somebody's bleeding and they're bleeding from a very large vein or an artery, they're going to bleed out in 5 or 10 minutes and they're not going to come back. And those are very survivable wounds if you have the knowledge and the ability to be there and make the intervention, which is nothing more than a tourniquet or compression. None of what I did was rocket science. It was, listen, he's bleeding. We need to stop it. And we need to put something in his veins continue to keep his blood pressure up. And that's what we did time and time again.
My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. His new memoir is called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick, and his new book, On Call in Hell, is about being a doctor during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004. There were things that you learned to improvise in Fallujah, like warming IV fluids by taping them to people's bodies, because it would get cold sometimes, and the cold IV would be very bad.
Right.
So what are some other things that you learned to improvise with experience?
Everything we do out in the military seems to be improvisation. You've got a certain amount of gear, but there are other things that you can utilize. We improvise every day by trying to figure out where we're going to set up our aid station. Our aid station happened to be a perfect place with, you have to think about access to it. You have to think about putting stretchers in it and getting gear for it. We improvised when it got cold. We improvised with the fires. We had the engineers kind of open up some holes in the wall, and we built little fireplaces in the wall. And when we knew the casualties were coming, we always had embers burning in there, and then we'd stoke them up because it got very cold. It got to 25, 26 degrees after Thanksgiving. So when that happens, what you're going to wind up doing is bringing a patient in, taking their clothes off, and figuring out where their wounds are and trying to plug these holes, but you're going to make them hypothermic. So we had two fireplaces going in our second aid station that we would just kick up, and you would sweat in the room when those things were going. So it really did work. And innovation is not, certainly wasn't my innovation. It was the Corman's innovation. They would come up with things that transfers of patients into the ambulances and how to use a loading dock was key, because we could move patients in and out faster when we had that set up. So we looked at everything out there as the opportunity to kind of improve your situation. One of the corpsmen came up with, we have to make latrines when we go out, or what we call in the Navy heads. And he came up with just a fantastic way to make heads out of sandbags. And it made it a lot more comfortable for anybody who had to use one.
Now, you're talking about how a lot of the injuries that you dealt with were bleeds, and what you did was often like pack the wound or apply a tourniquet. But some of the injuries you saw were brain injuries. How do you deal with those? Like a tourniquet isn't going to do the job.
For the most part, for a brain injury, you're bandaging the head and sending them out and trying to stabilize them as best you can. And I look at, their airway, their circulation, whether they've got any other bleeds going on. But I will tell you that in triage, if on the battlefield somebody is displaying brain tissue or gray matter, then there's very little you can do for them, and for the most part, comfort is what you give them, and we did that on occasions.
Were you able to call in medevacs, and were they able to arrive quickly for the injuries like brain injuries where there wasn't much that you could do?
There were no helo evacuations out of the city, and which is kind of where as the plan was being put together, and we thought about, hey, where are we going to have helicopter support? There really wasn't any way they were going to let helicopters fly over the city where they didn't know what kind of weapons and RPGs were going to be involved on all these rooftops. So because they were really trying to prevent a Black Hawk down, and I can't blame them for that, we on the ground had to be more innovative about our evacuations. So I evacuated, we did all self-evacuation. Everybody I had who was wounded and in the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, went back to an ambulance exchange point, which was way back about a mile and a half from my forward aid station. But it was through, a lot of times it was through Indian country. So there were, and the roads weren't good. So it was, I wanted to make sure that my guys were very stable before they made that trip. And then once they got back there, we'd exchange them with an ambulance that would take them into the combat surgical hospitals, or the Bravo Surgical, which happened to be the surgical company that was taking care of us in Camp Fallujah.
Was it difficult for you to decide? I assume it was like your job to decide when a Marine should be sent back into battle, if the wound was manageable enough that they could return to battle. Are those hard decisions to make?
They are. It is my decision. It was never a decision I took lightly. And I will tell you that on one occasion, I had a Marine come in who had been shot through his helmet. And he just walked in with his helmet under his arm and said, "Doc, I really, my head's killing me." And we looked at his head, and he had taken a sniper round that grazed the top of his scalp. He had splayed it open, but it didn't go through the bone. So he was probably the luckiest man I'd ever seen. The decision that day was, you need to go home. At least take the next couple of days off and come rejoin the group after you get that thing washed out. So we sent him home. Unfortunately, most of the Marines wanted to go back very quickly, and I treated that same day a young Lance Corporal DeMarcus Brown, who was really just had a lip laceration, and one of the corpsmen sewed it up, and he wanted to get back out there. And so we let him go, and his wound was pretty minimal, and our job is really to maintain the fighting force. That's what we need. We need people who are putting rounds downrange, and my job is really to make sure that that's happening and that people aren't just leaving. And I never had that with the 1st Battalion, 8th Marines. People did not want to leave, and DeMarcus Brown wanted to go back to his unit. So we sent him back out. Unfortunately, DeMarcus Brown came in the next day with a chest shot and didn't make it.
Sometimes the Marines who you saw were so mangled you couldn't tell who they were until reading their dog tags. And because some of these men were men who you'd known and already worked with, that must have been pretty upsetting.
Yeah, it's extremely upsetting. I think for me as an older person, it was something I really did compartmentalize and didn't deal with until I was gone. But I knew that the corpsman who lived with these guys and knew them well, there was a moment on almost every Marine, because they came in even if they were okay, they were beaten up, they were bloody, and they were dirty. They were covered in mud, and if they came in and they weren't with us anymore, if they were not alive, then there would certainly be some very serious wounds that were going on, and nobody really would understand who the Marine was until we started to really look into finding the dog tags. And there was this, what I call the moment of realization, and it was sad to watch, because people didn't know, and all they knew was that they had a Marine there, and then they would realize that that Marine was somebody they might have lived over top of them, somebody that they had gone out and drank beers with back at Camp Lejeune. And it was always a difficult thing to deal with for these kids, as they would have to put them in body bags and we'd have to evacuate them out of there.
Dr. Richard Jaddick will be back in the second half of the show. His new memoir is called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, sponsoring Philadelphia's new audio walking tours called Sound About Philly at soundaboutphilly.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Dr. Richard Jaddick tells us about treating some wounded insurgents along with wounded Marines during the Battle of Fallujah. And Ken Tucker reviews the new album by Iggy Pop and the Stooges, their first in nearly 35 years. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Navy Commander Dr. Richard Jaddick. He set up the medical aid stations during the Battle of Fallujah in Iraq and practiced combat medicine in the middle of the battle. He received a Bronze Star with a Combat V for valor. His new memoir is called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. In addition to treating Marines in the Battle of Fallujah, you treated some civilians. You also treated some insurgents. Why did you treat insurgents, and what do the rules of war have to say about treating the enemy?
The rules are that you're supposed to treat everybody that's out there on the battlefield. First of all, I'll say that because of my Hippocratic Oath, the oath that I've taken to become a physician, I was going to treat everybody anyway. I didn't have a problem with that. I was able to come to terms with the fact that, you know, if they're insurgents, it's not my job to judge who lives and who dies. It's my job to put my skills to effectively treat and manage their wounds. Now, there were some bad men that came through my aid station that I treated, and the way I discussed it with my corpsmen who were having problems with it was, you know, these are guys who they stayed because they wanted to become martyrs. To become a martyr, they have to die, and if we can keep them alive, then that takes away the only reason they were here. So it was a little reverse psychology, but in reality, our job was, on top of that, to provide a healthy patient to the intelligence people so they could talk to them and try and get some sort of information out of it so that in the future that we can save our own, you know, our Marines, our lives. And then there was always the fact that sometimes a poor guy came in, may have been caught up, may have not, may be an insurgent, and I just didn't know. And I wasn't there to make that determination. So I treated everybody very equally. I never had the situation where I had to make a choice between do I treat a Marine or do I treat an insurgent. It was always at an appropriate time that I could treat either one equally.
What about the security aspects of the insurgents in the same aid station as the Marines were? And did you have to worry about security even though the insurgents were wounded?
Absolutely. No insurgent came into the aid station without having two Marines on them and having been completely strip searched. Even then, I had probably four or five known Iraqi insurgents that they had dug out of a house, and they came into us, and one was sitting on the ground, blindfolded, hands tied behind his back, and he bit into one of my corpsmen. So even then, safety, you always have to be on guard. And we always had a very well-trained force of Marines who would stand off and watch us treat the patients, because the last thing I want to do is have my corpsman with weapons trying to do that and treat a patient, and then the insurgent can actually get a hold of a weapon. So we were very thorough in how we dealt with insurgents who came in, and always concerned paramount over everything was the security of ourselves, and the Marines did a very good job of that.
So when you were treating insurgents who knew that you were an American doctor with the Navy, did they look at you like they really would prefer to kill you, or did they look at you with gratitude for treating them?
There was never, and it was different with different people. The hardcore insurgents never looked at me with gratitude. They hated everything I stood for, everything I was about. But you know, hate's a painful thing to carry around with you. So I tried very hard not to have that with me. I wanted to get rid of it, do what I had to do, and be proud of what I did, and not walk around with this significant hate that would eat me up inside. That's what these guys had. I mean, they had a burning hate. There were quite a few kind of lower tier insurgents, guys who probably didn't think that we'd actually come through, who were paid to stay in town, not paid a lot of money, but more money than they've probably seen ever in their lives. And these were guys who did feel relief that they had been captured, relief that we were treating them. And hopefully when they go back and they're offered a couple $100 to do the same thing again, they think about it and say, well, I don't know, it doesn't make sense. So that's why we worked hard at treating them all the same.
Fallujah was your first combat experience, and what an experience it was. You describe in your memoir what it was like the first time you had to, like, exit your vehicle and go into battle to try to save lives, and how, like, your body was crying out, stay put, don't move, don't go there. Would you describe that moment and how you kind of got the power to go against your instincts and go out into fire and do your job?
There was that moment when that door open, and we had heard rounds pinging off the side, and I was there with the with an Army specialist who was a medic, specialist cook, and he was in the vehicle with me, and we looked outside, and it was crazy outside, chaotic, loud, something that, I mean, I think the closest I ever saw was Saving Private Ryan when the ramp dropped and they hit the beach. A round had come into the vehicle, and I was scared. I mean, I don't think anybody's not scared. I was completely afraid, and it took every cell in my body to kind of muster up the courage to go outside. And what wound up for me and in my head as I sat there and I was kind of pivotal on this knife's edge, you know, why would I go outside? Why not just go back, treat them when they get in here? I was afraid that I was going to fail those Marines that really wanted, who I owed my security and my allegiance to, and that's why I moved. I was afraid to fail. I needed something to motivate me, and that was it. And I will never forget how, as I stood there, thinking it was for hours, but hopefully it was only a split second, all of a sudden that thought came into my head that if you don't go out now and you don't do what you're trained to do, you have failed your team. And I don't know if I could have lived with myself if that had happened.
You wanted combat experience. You felt cheated that you didn't get to be in combat during the 1991 Gulf War. Can you explain that very human paradox that on the one hand you really want to see combat and do your job in combat, at the same time when you're in combat, all your instincts tell you to be safe and not enter combat?
You know, it's a lot easier to sit on the sidelines and say, hey, that's what I want to do. But when you're actually placed out there, you realize that there's a lot of things that are not what you expected. But at the same time, for me, in the first Gulf War, I was on a football team. This is kind of the way I look at it. And I had trained with the team. I had practiced with the team. And I wanted to go, and I wanted to play the game. And unfortunately, back then, I didn't even get out of the locker room. So I felt a little cheated. You don't train and prepare for something, and then when that event occurs, you want to be a part of it. And you want to be a part of history, and you want to be a part of things that are bigger than you. This synergy that occurs on the battlefield that you read about and that you hear about, you want to feel that. And that's what I wanted. Now, I will say that when I first got off that ambulance that afternoon, I thought about all that and realized that, wow, it's not the glory that I thought it was going to be.
My guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. His new memoir is called On Call in Hell, A Doctor's Iraq War Story. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Richard Jaddick. He's a naval doctor who saved a lot of lives during the Battle of Fallujah in 2004 in Iraq. He's written a memoir called On Call in Hell. He got a Bronze Star with a Combat V for Valor for his work during the Battle of Fallujah. You know, getting back to what we were talking about before, like overcoming the instincts to keep safe, how are you changed by seeing so much death? And seeing so many, you know, mangled bodies and severe wounds. I guess what I'm wondering is, you know, you'd worked in a trauma unit in Baltimore, so you had some experience with trauma, but not with combat. As your time went on, and you were in the Battle of Fallujah for about a month, What changed in you emotionally that made it possible for you to keep dealing with this for several weeks nonstop?
Well, I had my wife and my daughter at home, so for me there was no failure. I was going home and I was going to be normal. So I compartmentalized everything. I put it really somewhere else. I never thought I'd have to deal with it again, and I would probably not have dealt with it again if the Bronze Star hadn't come out and the Newsweek article hadn't come out. Because when I went home, I sat with my wife and my daughter, and we talked about everything except Iraq. And I never talked about any of that for a year. And then the Bronze Star came out, and the Newsweek article came out, and I had to talk about it. It was probably one of the most cathartic interviews I've ever done. And it was a very painful 7 days that I did this every night with Pat Wingert. And that has helped me get through a lot of it. I think that the changes that I've endured are really, I know how precious life is, every life. And it's something that makes me want to be home with my family, because I need to watch all that's going on. I want to see my daughters grow up. I want to see my wife every day. So those are things that I've learned to appreciate that I don't think I did before. I'm in medicine, so I will always see bad outcomes. And you have to put that aside to deal with the rest of your life, I guess.
Your wife was pregnant when you volunteered to go to Iraq, to be deployed to Iraq, and she had just given birth when you actually left. That must have been so difficult for her and for you, and I could see that she might have been upset that you decided to do it, that you decided to go while she was about to give birth.
She's always been very supportive of what I've done or what I've had to do, and that's who I am. That is, she married a certain person who does those things, and I think she realized it, and at the same time didn't realize that sometimes the sacrifice was very large, having given birth, I had, before even any of this, I went to the delivery. I was there for all of it. But as every military guy knows, you really distance yourself from everything that's going on probably 2 weeks or so before you deploy. So you have to separate your emotions from the emotions that are going on around you, or else you'll never get out of there.
Well, can I stop you for a second? So you're talking
sure.
about how you distance yourself about 2 weeks before you deploy, but isn't it within that 2 weeks that your wife actually gave birth?
It is.
So you're trying to distance yourself emotionally just as you're seeing your wife give birth to your daughter.
Yeah, well, you have to, or else because I remember when my wife gave birth and I held my daughter for the first time, that there was a very, if I had not had some sort of mechanism to get over that, I could see myself not going. I could see myself going UA. I could see what happens to kids who do all that. But I didn't, because I have been through this before, and I have the experience of knowing how to put this stuff aside so that you have to focus on what's going forward. Hopefully my daughter is going to be okay with it when she gets older and says, you left me for my first year. I don't know. Well, we'll see how that works out. But, you have to do something. You need some mechanism to get out of town.
When you were in the Battle of Fallujah, you carried a gun. I thought medical personnel weren't supposed to carry a gun. Am I wrong about that?
We are supposed to carry a gun.
You are supposed to carry a gun.
Yes.
Yeah.
We're not supposed to be an aggressive combatant on the battlefield. However, that has to be taken, with with the thought that we also have to protect ourselves and our patients,
mm-hmm.
And that's why we carry a weapon. My job is really to, and my focus is on the patient. I only carried a sidearm, but my corpsmen all carried M16s and were capable of firing them if need be, and they needed to be to protect themselves against an enemy that was asymmetrical and could be anywhere at any time, and they needed to protect their patients.
So did you ever have to use the gun?
I never fired my pistol. I used it in defensive when we were on patrol down the middle of Fallujah. I used it really to cover corners. I was ready to shoot it if I had to, but I didn't have to. There was a situation on the outside of the aid station in the government center where a sniper was on a rooftop and had opened fire on us as we were treating casualties. And I looked up and I saw this this very deadly ring of fire coming from a muzzle. And it was very direct. It was a very perfect ring, which usually means that if it's a perfect ring, it's not off-center. They're firing somewhere in your direction. And luckily for me, the XO, Mark Wynn, was standing there, and I looked at him. I said, "Hey, Mark, there is a sniper on that rooftop," and I pointed to it, and just as we pointed, there was a shot, and he saw it, and he was able to neutralize the sniper.
Just one more thing. You said that when you came back to the States, you didn't really talk to your wife about what you saw in Iraq for about a year. And it wasn't until the Newsweek cover story on you was published, it wasn't until you were doing the interviews for that, that you really started talking about it, and it ended up being cathartic. I guess, you know, not having been in battle myself, it's hard for me to understand how you would not talk about it after getting... And I know it's really typical for soldiers when they get back to not want to talk about it with their families, but when the most extraordinary and dangerous thing you've ever experienced has happened to you and survived, how do you not talk about it?
Well, there was no reason for me to talk about it. My wife, at that point, didn't know that I had gone into the Battle of Fallujah, and I had never told her. I said, "Yes, we are a part of that battle, but I am on base camp." So there was no reason to go into it any further. She knew that there was more to it because I had called her once on a satellite phone when it was a quiet night, and as we were talking, they became very loud with explosions from one of the C-130s overhead had been bombing some insurgents on a rooftop. So she knew something was up, and she never asked me because she knew that sooner or later we would talk about it. But you can't talk to just anybody about it because people don't understand. And I've known now that I've spoken to people who've never been in combat that they look at you very funny as you tell the story. They look at you in disbelief that, you know, you had to make some decisions, and then they always ask questions that I'm not sure I'm ready to answer. So I think for most of us, when we come back, we don't even know how to talk about it. We don't know how. You don't just tell the story. You don't want to admit the fear. So the only people you really can talk to are those people who have experienced it, because it's easy to walk up to somebody and say, who's been in combat, and as you're talking, say, "Gosh, I was so scared." But it's hard to look at somebody that hasn't experienced and say that same thing, because they don't know how to take it. So I think a lot of kids just don't bring it up and don't talk about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and wish you good luck. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great to be on the show.
Dr. Richard Jaddick's new memoir is called On Call in Hell. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews the first album in nearly 35 years by Iggy Pop and the Stooges. This is Fresh Air. The Stooges, the rock band led by singer Iggy Pop, have just released their first album in almost 35 years, called The Weirdness. These days, Iggy Pop's best-known piece of music may be the riff for his song Lust for Life, which was used prominently in the movie Trainspotting and more recently in a TV commercial for a cruise ship line. But with the Stooges in the late 60s and early 70s, Iggy Pop was a forerunner of much of the punk and metal music that followed. Rock critic Ken Tucker listened to the new Stooges album to hear how it measures up.
Free and Freaky in the USA, Iggy Pop sings on that new song. It's an image Iggy has certainly reveled in the past. To some, Iggy is as well known for his onstage antics, such as rolling around in broken glass or smearing himself with peanut butter, as he is for his music. But these days, Free and Freaky is the coin of the realm, and you have to back it up with craft and novel ideas. I'm not sure a song like this achieves those things.
Attention.
The chorus there, in case you couldn't make it out, is, "My idea of fun is killing everyone." Come on, Iggy, you can do better than that. Cheap nihilism was always the most irritatingly lazy trait of Stooges music. And indeed, elsewhere on The Weirdness, Iggy and the Stooges do get better, as on this song called Trollin'. At one point on that song, Iggy bellows, "Rock critics wouldn't like this at all." But methinks Iggy protests too knowingly. It was rock criticism, after all, that helped keep Iggy's reputation alive until his great mid-70s collaborations with David Bowie. Their albums, The Idiot and Lust for Life, refined the sound described by the title of the definitive Stooges album, 1973's Raw Power. For years, this guy who was making music designed to turn on big crowds without managing to attract a large audience had his name invoked respectfully by rock writers who heard him as an influence, acknowledged or not, on everyone from the Sex Pistols to Metallica. Now the challenge is to make good on all those decades of goodwill with good music.
I feel so strange. Fear runs around my brain. Was born, formed from the clay of their unhappy ways. One word
That's Iggy Pop channeling his inner David Bowie on one of the Weirdness's rare mid-tempo songs, the title tune, and also one of the album's best. The new recording features original guitarist Ron Ashton, his brother, drummer Scott Ashton, and saxophonist Steve McKay, with Mike Watt from the punk band The Minutemen on bass. The Stooges' original bassist, Dave Alexander, died in 1975. They play with a lot of precise crunch. The Stooges know that in this age of technical precision, raw power doesn't really mean playing with artless rawness. You have to try and hear past Iggy's tired lyrical subjects. Fairweather friends hit you up for money, women can't be trusted, people are, to quote and in general, greedy and awful. Instead, you need to let the words fade away and listen to the aged grain of Iggy's voice and the slam and tickle of the guitars and drums. If you can do that, the Stooges sound, if not like Legends Reborn, at least a better, more raucous hard rock band than most of the current ones that are 20 years younger than the Stooges are.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the Stooges' new album, The Weirdness. You can now download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Books, publisher of The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes by William Ury, author of Getting Past No. From Kay and Matthew Buxbaum, whose Buxbaum International Fellowship trains journalists for reporting from all over the world. Details are at npr.org. And from the Skoll Foundation, connecting social entrepreneurs around the world with an online community called Social Edge. Learn more at socialedge.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, brothers Rob and Nate Cordry. Former correspondents for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Now Rob has a new sitcom on Fox in which he plays a 32-year-old virgin still living at home. And Nate plays a sketchwriter and performer on the NBC series Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip. Join us for the next Fresh Air.